Good morning, this is Hugh LaFont, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with George Graham, Reed Chair in Philosophy at Wake Forest University, and we're discussing John Doris's book, Lack of Character. George, glad to have you in the show.
I'm delighted.
I wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a brief synopsis of what you take Doris to be arguing in his book, Lack of Character.
Well, the title speaks to, I think, what the substance of the book is about. It is thought by many of us, myself included, that as human beings, as persons, each of us possesses a kind of character or set of traits that distinguish us, morally speaking, from each other. And Doris thinks that this conception that we have about ourselves is inadequate, and that in point of fact, we lack this character which we think we have. For example, in my case, I think of myself as a moderately honest and decent and generous person, somebody that keeps his promises and remains loyal to his friends. These are regarded by me, no doubt, without humility, as parts of my character, or constituents of my character, and Doris is claiming, in effect, that in some deep sense, I'm quite mistaken, that those are not general character traits of mine. Not because I'm not honest, or not because I'm not generous, or not because I'm not loyal. It's because honesty, generosity, and loyalty simply are not features of us as persons, in spite of the fact that we think they are. It's not that I simply lack them. It's that any and all of us lack them. Hence, we lack character.
Wow. That certainly sounds like a very strong claim. I wonder if we can sort of go back then and ask, what does he mean by character? And maybe that'll give us some clue about exactly where and how and why he disagrees with you and probably most of the listeners.
Well, one of the things that I know you know, Hugh, as a professional philosopher, is that as philosophers, we love to make distinctions between different meanings of one and the same word. So, for example, we'll take a word like character, and we'll say, here's meaning one, here's meaning two, here's meaning three. Okay, let's look at ordinary language. When we say that someone has character, sometimes what we mean is that they are a character. They're an odd person or a funny person or a person that is not quite in sync with the group that they're in. Sometimes when we say that someone has character or possesses character, we mean that they're a bit of an actor. They walk around with a guise or a persona that they put on, a kind of stage presence. Okay, he has nothing to say about those two notions of character. What he means by character is what many people speak of when they talk of moral education and moral development and moral training and moral behavior. They're talking about traits or characteristics that we have as persons when we're involved in relations with other people, most especially those when we're called upon or asked to acknowledge our responsibilities and hearken to our duties and do what's right rather than what's wrong, do what's just rather than what's unjust or unfair. Moral character, which is sometimes spoken of as our morally virtuous characteristics that we might have as persons. And he thinks that if we're going to talk about character at all, then we have to acknowledge that to make real sense of this word or sense of this concept, these traits, these character traits that we have to arise and appear and express themselves in a wide variety of situations. They have to be what he sometimes calls stable. They have to be the kind of traits that will appear when we're really pressed and tempted to fold. So they have to be what may be called robust. And they have to be traits that we assess and we evaluate and we modify and we change when we see our successes or failures of living up to what we think we ought to do. We have to evaluate them periodically so they're stable or consistent across situations, they're robust, and they're open and receptive to being analyzed and evaluated by us. Of course, that's a pretty heavy concept. I mean, that's got a lot of stuff in it. But basically, he's really talking about just being a kind of person that exhibits moral features in a wide variety and range of situations.
I take it that that description of character or analysis of character is one that you're comfortable with.
To some extent, I am. To some extent, I'm not. I am in the sense that I think there are some people that possess character of that sort, though the standard or the bar that I've just described is very high. My own view about how best to understand character is somewhat different than Doris's, though it's in the same family. Here's an example that I'm going to give you that has nothing at all to do with character, but then I'm going to make a remark about character that follows from it. If I ask you to think of a bird, very likely you're going to form a mental picture of a blue jay or perhaps a pigeon or a cardinal. Very unlikely are you going to form a mental image of a penguin, and yet penguins are birds. What we do when we form concepts, I think, is we pick out sort of what are sometimes called prototypes or clear-cut cases or obvious cases of a concept, like a bird, or I could do the same thing for a chair or the same thing for a car. I like to think of character that way. When I think of character, I think of, say, the New York City fireman who went up into the World Trade Center, or the members of our armed forces who might be able to risk their lives in a war with Iraq, or miners that go down when their colleagues have been trapped in a mine. I think of people who rise to the mark, not in each and every situation, but in those special situations where they're truly called on to do something that's dutiful, responsible, and good and fair and right and just, if you will. These are the prototypes, the exemplars of character. So he doesn't really mention that in the book or discuss it. He's got some discussion of it, but not the way I would like to see it. Let's give you an example. We all know and admire people like Mother Teresa, for example. I don't think I'd be crushed to discover that were she a citizen of the United States, she cheats on her income tax, or every now and then she doesn't quite tell the Mother Superior or the Pope where she's going and goes out and catches a movie. Because here is really an exemplary person who rises to the mark in the streets of Calcutta, and she therein possesses character. It may not be consistent character, stable character, emerging in a wide variety of situations. So that's what I drop off Doris's account. That notion of consistency and stability, I think, is much too strong and doesn't really capture the kind of character that we have as persons and that we admire in other human beings.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think in some ways that is pretty key to what's going on, and maybe the source of some of the differences here, that he does seem to acknowledge in the book that a person does not have to always be honest to nonetheless be considered an honest person, or always be benevolent to be considered a benevolent person. But he thinks that there are, as almost as you put it, sort of standard situations where someone does rise to the mark and you expect him to do so. And he's going to want to claim that that, in fact, doesn't happen, that in a wide variety of cases, many of us don't, in fact, rise to the mark. How important is this notion of consistency for his view, and why do you think it's just not as important as he seems to think it is?
Once again, here I am a philosopher, so I'm going to take a concept like consistency and say, well, it can mean A, it can mean B. So A is consistent means appears again and again in a wide variety of situations. B, consistency means appears in those situations where we have good reason to expect it to appear, to want it to appear, and if it doesn't appear, we're no longer going to call the person courageous if courage is the character, or honest if honesty is the character. Now, consistency in the A sense, we ain't God as human beings, except for people who might have clinical problems where they're sort of locked intractably into a form of behavior. They're compulsively honest, compulsively punctual, compulsively generous, again and again and again, no matter the situation. We're intelligent, sensitive people, most of us, I would trust, and certainly listeners of this show are, or they wouldn't be listening to it. And part of what it means to be an intelligent, sensitive person is to discriminate between situation A and situation B and situation C. Situation A may not call for honesty. Situation B may not call for generosity. Situation C may not call for courage. We discriminate between these situations, and our powers of discriminating between them are part of what give us the personalities that we have, which mean the kind of persons that we are. I confess that when I read what Doris has to say, and it's an extremely well-written and challenging book, and I'm very pleased to have read it, but I confess that when I read what Doris has to say, although he does point out that there are stress situations where we expect people who have a relevant character trait to rise to the mark and behave in an appropriate way, his understanding of failure in those situations is to read them as saying absence of character, lack of character. My reading of those situations is quite different than his. My reading is, let's look at the long haul. Follow that person throughout the course of his or her life. Maybe when he or she is participating in the Milgram experiment at Yale, he or she is imposing a great deal of bizarre pain, or what they think is bizarrely inflicted pain in another human being. But track them a week later, track them a month later, track them a year later, track them 5 years later. Take them out of that Yale environment and put them someplace else. In the Holocaust, for example, there were people who got co-opted in the madness of Nazism and both directly and indirectly participated in the evils of that absolutely, utterly horrendous experience. But there were other people who showed tremendous courage and risked their own life and property and rose to the moral mark to help save some sense of humanity in a world that had gone absolutely crazy with evil. They had character. So when I speak of thinking of character and rising to the mark, it's mark over the long haul. It's not mark in situation A or situation B. It's mark over the course of a life, over the course of a series of stresses. And unlike Doris, I guess I believe there's more of that around than he thinks there is.
Okay, well, that really takes us to the heart of his book, which is he claims that there is strong empirical evidence that there just isn't character of the sort that you're talking about. I mean, it's not that there aren't the individuals, the rare individuals who have this character, but that for the most part, most of us don't have it. And there are two sorts of things that he does in his book where he tries to argue that. One is the use of certain social psychological experiments like the Milgram experiment that you mentioned, and also by looking a bit at actual history in the case of the Holocaust. I mean, maybe let's begin with the latter, since you did bring it up. I can imagine, it seems to me, what he would want to say is this. Look, what did the majority of Germans do? The majority of Germans locked in step with what the higher echelon wanted. The majority of Germans either participated directly in the Holocaust or at least looked the other way. And yes, there were individuals who were brave, who were courageous, who challenged it, but those, they were really few and far between. Most people did what they were expected to do by the government. Now, there are two choices. One is we can say that Germans are a uniquely evil, unprincipled, uncharactered people, or we can say that there's something about the situation that led them to behave as they did. And the real difference in the behavior between individuals then is not internal character, but external situations.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you say to that? How do you explain your position in light of that sort of move, which he clearly wants to make in his book?
Well, my view is, look at the people who not only failed to rise to the mark, but sunk into the depths of evil, and track them after the Holocaust and in the rest of their lives. He calls this longitudinal analysis, and he bemoans the fact that for obvious reasons, longitudinal analyses are incredibly difficult to put together. I suspect, if I'm right, what one is going to find is that the people who participated in the mass exterminations on other occasions, in other situations, a number of them which pressed them, to use the metaphor I use, did rise to the mark. Let's take a New York City fireman, for example. I grew up in the city of New York, and I grew up in an ethnic neighborhood. And the ethnic neighborhood that I grew up in was Scotch-Irish. And in those days, it was not uncommon to find that many of these people were racists. And it was not uncommon to bully people that were not Scotch-Irish. And I used to think of this as completely indefensible behavior, but I was a skinny kind of kid, weighed about 14 pounds, and I didn't have much to do about it. The very same boys in my neighborhood who used to be bullies on 15 other occasions would do incredible stuff for people, run out in front of a car and grab a girl from being hit, help an old woman that had fallen down on the street. That's what I mean by longitudinality. Racism, which I think was one of the elements through an analog of that in anti-Semiticism during the Holocaust, can be a powerful motive force and a constituent of someone's personality. It's not so much that the situation has taken charge of their behavior as something else about them, a trait that's not character in the moral sense, but a trait nonetheless, a personality trait. They are racists or they're anti-Semites. And it's that trait that's kicking in a Holocaust-type situation. It's not that there aren't situational factors that are playing a role, but there still is some background characteristic of a person which is making them liable, susceptible, vulnerable, or even attractable to behaving in a morally odious way. So situation plus personality, I think, is a factor here. And then, as I said before, look over the long haul. Look longitudinally. And then lastly, what connected with this, the obverse of character or the negative sibling of character is being kind of a unvirtuous, vicious person. And there's also some evidence to suggest, I think, that you can run an argument like his for viciousness in people not being a trait. But once again, I would charge that if you look at people's personalities and their behavior over the long haul, you will find that the person that might appear vicious in situation A appears unvicious, perhaps even virtuous in situation B, situation C, situation F, H, M, and whatever. So I'm looking at the same situations that he is, but I'm reading them through the lens or filter of a somewhat different notion of character, supplemented also by some notion that people have personalities which are also consistent and abiding features of their situation.
So would it be fair to say that part of the way of understanding the disagreement that you would have with Doris is over how to read particular sorts of behavior, which he reads as definitely counting against someone having character. You read them as an aberration. And again, the Holocaust. I mean, I'm assuming what he's going to say is, look, if that isn't a demonstration of the fact that someone is not benevolent, what else is?
Well, I would say someone is grossly malevolent under those in that context, but that the gross malevolence is not just a function of the situation. It's a function of other traits or characteristics of the person, not characteristics in the character sense, but characteristics in the sense of being abiding features of someone's personality or capacities of behavior.
For instance, being a conformist?
Yes, being a conformist or being an anti-Semite or being someone who is anxious to achieve some status in an emerging new political power structure, or being someone who is concerned about the welfare of his or her family, or about it being discovered that one's sister-in-law is married to a Jewish man, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, let me ask you this. I mean, it might appear to the listener that you think there's really not much at all going on, positive going on in his book, that he simply got the understanding of character wrong, and therefore he reaches the wrong conclusions. Is that your position?
No. My position is that, first off, he states his case very nicely. He writes very well, and readers who might be interested in looking at the book and reading it, I urge them to do so. So as a sheer piece of writing, it's very nicely done. But secondly, perhaps more importantly, there is a thesis here. There is a worry here about how best to understand human behavior. What part or parts of us, if any, are stable across situations, and what parts or parts of us are unstable across situations? Now, if you look at a psychologist like B.F. Skinner, for example, Skinner, in his book Beyond Freedom and Dignity and elsewhere, Walden 2, has claimed that human beings really can be controlled by the situations in which they live and by what Skinner calls the reinforcement schedules that are operative in those situations. His Society of Walden 2 is constructed so that the situation of that society, the way it's organized, produces the kind of behavior people want. That's situationism in the extreme. There's another position, kind of characterism in the extreme, where no matter the situation you're in, you're going to behave the same way. Now, of those two extremes, Doris floats over to the Skinnerian extreme. I am not recommending floating over to the no matter what situation you'll behave the same way extreme. I'm in the middle. I claim that people do possess character, properly understood, over time. Character sometimes is counter-influenced by situation and also by other traits of a person, personality traits of a person. So, for example, whether or not a person is a conformist or a racist also play a role in what they do. So I'm putting more variables, I see myself putting more variables into the story than he does. I'm putting personality traits, longitudinal features, and sort of background cultural circumstances, all filtering into the mix.
Okay, so to that extent, you might join him in criticizing what in some ways is the real target of his book, which is a view that seems to put almost exclusive emphasis on character.
Yes, I do. I think we live in thank you. There is this emphasis in our culture on the kind of, how should one put it, John Wayne conception of a person. That, you know, you stick them on the sands of Iwo Jima, or you put them in the Wild West, or you send them into a general brigade into Mexico, and he's always and everywhere John Wayne or Clint Eastwood. And this is quite dangerous and certainly grossly, totally incompatible with the kind of framework that Doris is introducing us to. Situations do play a role in what we do, and to deny that naively is to embark not only on a misconception of human nature, but to be completely poorly and ill-equipped in the moral education that we have to provide for young people in our society. We're not training people to be heroes, we're just training them to be persons.
And so to that extent, the thing he wants to argue that when we're thinking about morality, we need to be asking not just what kind of character do the individuals have, but also what kind of situations have we put people in?
Yes, I very much so. And I complain, and I'm sure the listeners complain too, about the situations that many of us are put in our culture and our society. For example, I tend to have a particular personal aversion to large malls or being in large auditoriums with large crowds of people or riding up a skyscraper with 40 or 50 stories. I find this very depersonalizing and dissociating, and yet many people live and work and breathe in those situations. And do we wonder then why they behave in anomic and counter-benevolent terms on occasion in these dissociated, alienated environments that people are growing up in? No. The situation that we're in does play an important role in how we behave. And insofar as Doris puts his finger on the role of situation, it's a very intelligent thing for him to do.
Okay, in the last 5 minutes, I'd like to talk about maybe the implications of his view for some things which I know are of interest to you professionally, that you're very much interested in psychotherapy, you're very much interested in the philosophical implications of and for the study of psychology, in particular in a clinical setting. what are some of the implications for his view for the clinical the practice of clinical psychology?
One implication is a paradoxical implication. It's suggested by some things he says, actually, and it is that rigidity of behavior across situations can oftentimes be a mark of one or another form of mental illness. Case in point, the obsessive-compulsive person, or the manic-depressive person, or the person that is suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, no matter the situation that they might be in the obsessive-compulsive case, they'll be locking and checking the doors, locking and checking the faucets, locking and checking the lights. In the case of a paranoid schizophrenic, they'll be reading this, that, and the other social encounter as having a negative impact on them. And what is needed oftentimes to liberate such a person from the grips of their illness is some method or means of making their behavior more situationally nuanced, alert, and sensitive, liberating it from its rigid consistency. Doris has some things to say in his book, which suggest, I think, that he would agree with what I just said. He points out that sometimes consistency across situations is not a mark of character, but it's a mark of potentially ill disorder. So that's one. Second, when we're thinking about the difference between mental and non-mental illness, or between mental disorder and mental health, we need, I think, to recognize not just that the characters of mentally ill people are threatened by their health, or the personalities of mentally ill people are threatened by their health or ill health, or their capacities to respond to situations are so threatened, but we, as persons who are treating them and caring for them and understanding them, can be personally threatened and challenged by the confrontation with a form of illness. We find it uncomfortable to be with people who are suffering from mental illness. We don't quite know how to deal with them or to talk to them or to encounter them. And this calls on us to display a certain, oftentimes, strength of character, a benevolence, a compassion, a willingness to listen, and a tolerance which we otherwise are not called on to ask. I mean, walk down the streets of a crowded city and you might spot a homeless person who perhaps has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and many people will just walk to the other side of the street or avert their eyes and not encounter that person and meet that person as a person, or have a colleague who's chronically depressed and melancholic, and if you're trying to decide who to have lunch with, you're not that likely to ask them to join you. And our character has to show forth in those situations. So those are just sort of two implications, if you will, of using his notions that come out of his book, among many others.
Yeah, would you want to give a sort of 30-minute summary of anything you would like, any thought you'd like to leave with the listener?
It's really critical, I think, Q, to have someone like a Doris state a thesis strongly, firmly, dramatically, to challenge us to think and get us off the lounge chair or the easy chair that we so often intellectually like to sit on. And this is a book that says, come on, get up, I'm going to give you an idea and I want you to think about it. But we also, I think, need to put more into the conceptual mix here than he does.
Well, thank you very much for bringing the show.
Okay, thank you.
I've been speaking today with George Graham, Reed Chair in Philosophy at Wake Forest University. We've been discussing John Doris's book, Lack of Character. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.